You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to the Wild Black Podcast, your safe space for all the moments, the great ones, the bad ones, the unbelievable ones, and the you gotta be kidding me ones. Wild Black brings on a different and dope guest every single week just to teach you, inspire you, entertain you, and simply make you better. When you need to vent about something or celebrate the amazingness that is us, Wild Black's got your back. Do yourself a favor and ride with us anywhere you listen to podcasts. Now go hit that play button.
The Old West is an iconic period of American history. I'm Chris Wimmer. Join me on the Legends of the Old West podcast to hear the true stories of lawmen like Wyatt Earp, Bass Reeves and the Texas Rangers, outlaws like Jesse James and Butch and Sundance, and Native American battles of the Lakota, Comanche, and Apache. We use cinematic storytelling and sound design to bring these stories and many more to life. Subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now.
Behind the scenes in Silicon Valley, Reid Hoffman, founder of LinkedIn and partner at Greylock, is a sought-after advisor to heads of companies and heads of state. On each episode of his podcast, Masters of Scale, he sits down with a guest from an all-star list of visionary founders and leaders, digging into the surprising strategies that power their company's growth. Now, in his new book, Masters of Scale, Surprising Truths from the World's Most Successful Entrepreneurs, Hoffman draws on their most riveting and revealing stories, as well as his own experience as a founder and investor, to distill the secrets behind the most extraordinary success stories of our times. Here, Hoffman teams up with Masters of Scale's executive producers, June Cohen and Darren Trifto, to offer a rare window into the entrepreneurial mind, sharing hard-won wisdom from leaders of iconic companies, including Apple, Nike, Netflix, Spotify, Starbucks, Google, Instagram, and Microsoft, as well as the bold, disruptive startups such as 23andMe, TaskRabbit, Blacklist, and Walker & Company that are solving the problems of the 21st century. And on today's podcast, I sit down with Reid Hoffman and June Cohen, who is also the co-founder and CEO of the podcast network Wait What, to talk about the entrepreneurial mindset, the keys to blitzscaling your way to success, and the underrated importance of a company's culture. Plus, they explain the value of embracing resistance, the various kinds of no's that one hears in a VC meeting, the difference between a good no and a bad no, and the time Reid said no to a startup when he should have said yes. Coming up with the Masters of Scale, Reid Hoffman and June Cohen in just a moment. Co-founder of LinkedIn, partner at Greylock, and host of Masters of Scale podcast, and June Cohen is the co-founder and CEO of Wait What. They are the co-authors of a new book called Masters of Scale, Surprising Truths from the World's Most Successful Entrepreneurs. Reid Hoffman and June Cohen, welcome to the podcast.
Awesome to be here.
Oh, great to be here with you, Ben.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And you know, as we were just discussing, you know, before we went on mic here, it's always good to talk to fellow podcasters, people who kind of understand what it's like to be in the trenches of podcasting and that kind of thing. You know, the book is a natural extension of your podcast, Masters of Scale. I'm curious, what gave you the idea to take the podcast and turn it into a book? And what is that like, translating an interview show into written text like this?
Ben, it's interesting. Masters of Scale is a case of a podcast that from before we launched the podcast, we never thought of it as just a podcast. We actually knew from before we launched our first episode that we wanted to take the entrepreneurial wisdom we would be gathering from Rita and our guests and over time extend it into books, into curriculum, into gatherings of a community. And so we actually had it in mind from even before the very first episode. So I'd start there.
Well, I'm curious, is that where you two teamed up? Was it the partnership born out of the podcast, or did you know each other before that?
We knew each other before. We may have even met through Stanford connections. I think it was John Lilly. June was the executive producer of TED, had been doing all kinds of amazing things, and you know, including you know the kind of these ideas spreading through the world. And so we chatted about media and the importance about aspiration, about what kinds of things you can build, and had talked over a number of years. And then I had been doing this course at Stanford on blitzscaling. No, actually, I think this was before. I think you called me before that, before I got into that. That was actually, I was working on blitzscaling. And then, you know, June called me and said, hey, what do you think about a podcast, Masters of Scale? And I was like, podcasts? I've heard they're kind of interesting.
Right? Yeah, you know, I'm curious because here you are, you're two people who, this is sort of a natural extension of the podcast, this book. But, you know, June, you had great success prior to this, bringing TED Talks online, and Reed, you, of course, had LinkedIn and PayPal and all of these success stories under your belt. So what made both of you want to do a podcast?
Maybe I'll pick up from there since I brought the idea to Reed for very specific reasons. And, you know, Reed and I shared such an interest in so many things, from spreading knowledge to organic growth online. And the coming out of TED, the reason my co-founder Darren Triff and I left TED after a combined 17 years was because there was a renaissance happening in storytelling. There was a renaissance happening in podcasting, a renaissance happening in online video as well, and we wanted to be a part of it. And when we launched our new company, Wait What, the first question we asked ourselves is, we asked two questions. What community would really welcome a podcast? And the first community that came to mind was entrepreneurs, because they are so hungry for wisdom and it matters to them every day. And the second question we asked ourselves independently of that is, who should host a podcast, not just in business, but generally, who deserves an even bigger platform in the world? Who will people want to spend time with, and who will care about spreading their knowledge? And Reed was at the top of that list.
Well, I have to say, you have an impressive list of guests here, you know, and many of them are featured in the book as well. Mark Cuban, Barack Obama, Bill Gates, A-Rod, Tyra Banks, some people that are sort of, you wouldn't think would be on a podcast like this, but then there's Reed Hastings of Netflix, Eric Schmidt, Howard Schultz, the list goes on and on. You know, and many of them are prominently featured in the book, as I mentioned. But I wonder, when you sit down with a founder to pick their brain, what are you usually looking for? What do you want to get out of them?
Well, the thing that I think is most essential is that when someone has run this path, there are key mindsets, key tools, key insights that they have done in order to be successful. There's so many ways to fail in entrepreneurship and in trying to get to scale, that's the reason why you look for the possible patterns and tools of success that people, you know, everyone in the world can use as possible lessons, possible stories, possible emotional connections. And so you're looking for that thing that is kind of the unique, you know, kind of insight, journey, perspective, lessons, you know, kind of grit from this person. And so you're looking for the magic from them. So it's not like, oh, we're trying to tell the complete story. This is the complete story of Tyra Banks. This is the complete story of Franklin Leonard. This is the complete story of Arianna Huffington. We're not trying to say that. What we're trying to say is, here is a really important thing that this person has learned and developed and is worth everyone knowing. And so it's the magic of them.
And I have to say, one thing that I appreciate about both the podcast and the book is you like to dig into the difficult parts, the misfires, the hard-won lessons. I'm curious, do you ever encounter founders who just want to kind of stick to the rehearsed narrative about the company and don't really want to talk about what I guess you and I would probably consider the really good stuff? And how do you drag that out of them?
Well, so So we basically pre-qualify. We talk a lot to people before we get into it, and we're not willing to do the shilled, you know, generic story. That's not worth anyone's time. That's not worth our listeners' time. That's not worth our readers' time. That's not worth our time. It's no. When you actually get that magic, it's important. And so you talk in advance, and then you establish trust. You establish the fact that what people realize is you're not going to bother having them on the show unless you think that there's magic there that you're trying to share with the people who are listening to you or the people who are reading you. And actually, part of my delight is when, you know, June and crew bring people who, like, I would have never thought of that become this amazing thing. And like Tyra was one of those. Like, I didn't know, like, you know, supermodel, what do I know? And they're like, oh no, she's amazing. And I'm like, you're right, she's amazing. I learned a whole bunch in the conversation. And so that's what you're looking for.
Yeah, I actually love the Tyra Banks interview. And some of the most interesting stories in this book are those female CEOs like Whitney Wolf Hurd, who left Tinder and created Bumble, or Sarah Blakely, the founder of Spanx, or the founder of Rent the Runway. These are women who identify a need that women have that isn't being served by the male-dominated business community. And I kind of love that idea of, you know, the mother of invention is necessity, and often it's one person's, you know, realization of that necessity. And then suddenly that second realization that there are millions and millions of other people who have this need. And the stories of female CEOs were particularly interesting. I'm curious, June, do you have a favorite among those stories?
So hard to choose. Let me make one note there, Ben, in that, and I think you may know this, but the inclusion of all these female entrepreneurs as well as entrepreneurs of color wasn't accidental. It's actually a funny story. Reed and I, when we first decided to do the podcast, we sat down and we wrote our aspirational list. Who are the 10 entrepreneurs we want to have in our first season? And then we wrote it down. And then the next day we both came back and we're like, 9 of those 10 are white guys. That's not the show we want to create. Let's not do what everybody else does. And we actually made the commitment up front. I pitched it to Reed gently. I was like, what if we committed to a 50-50 gender balance, to have gender balance in our guests over time? And Reed being Reed, he was like, sure, which is not a response I've ever gotten in my whole career up until then. And we just committed to it up front. And you have to commit to it up front, by the way, in shows, because it's women stay under the radar. They are much more likely to say no. They are much more likely to cancel. I encountered this at TED for years and years, and we knew that going in. And to extremes, you know, there'd be times I'd invite 6 men and 6 women to an event, and 5 men would say yes and 5 women would say no. The differential is extreme. But we went in with this determination to have just a really balanced mix. And I have to say, one of my favorite stories is Angela Arendt's. And the particular story was Angela Arendt's was the high-flying CEO of Burberry, by records in the press, the most highly paid executive in UK. She was so happy there. And she was recruited to go to Apple to take a step back in many ways as head of retail. She was like, it's Apple. And ultimately I had to do it. She turned them down like 10 times, which to me was a lesson in like being persistent when you're recruiting someone. Don't take no as their final answer. That comes out in Reed's story as well. And then Reed asked her, so you get to Apple, how were your first months? And she's like, I hated it. She lost all her confidence. She felt like she was on Mars. She didn't know why she was there. And she was like, and then I lost my confidence. And finally, I'm like, Angela, you got to pick yourself up. And just to hear Angela Arendt say that, to be able to be willing to admit that she lost her confidence and that she had to give herself a pep talk, the power of that you can't even measure. As a founder myself, listening, and says like 65% of our audience is founders, and the rest are like intrapreneurs who are trying to drive something forward and who have those moments of doubt. It is just so powerful. And so anyway, that's my favorite moment, Ben.
Honestly, women are much more honest about their doubts and the mistakes that they made, and, you know, times when they weren't quite sure about something than men. You know, men tend to want to project confidence around every corner. But I think there's a lot of value in talking to women because they're just frankly more upfront about those sort of things.
Yeah, I totally. And just as June said, it's a lot of work to put into it. Like, for example, one of the questions which I will now share for the first time on this podcast that I get asked is, who are the guests that you most want to have? And I had previously not been saying that because I kind of felt like it wasn't the right thing to do. Got asked this, you know, kind of earlier in the week. And like Rihanna we'd love to have Rihanna. And we just kind of figure out, how do we make that bridge happen? So because her story would be so essential to the entrepreneurial community, and it's more work in order to make it work, but it's essential for all of us.
Okay. Well, we're going to put that out there and make it happen. Rihanna, if you're listening, or we'll put it on social media, one way or another, we'll make it happen here. And I applaud you for wanting to put together such a diverse group of entrepreneurs, not just women, but people of color. You even talk a little bit about ageism in Silicon Valley, which has for a long time been a serious problem because the Silicon Valley tends to favor the young. The assumption is that those are the innovators. As you approach, you're in your 50s now, and you know, you're getting up there, in, at least in Silicon Valley terms. Is ageism a big problem still? And is that something that's starting to change? Where do you weigh the value of the wisdom versus the perceived status as an innovator and a young forward thinker?
This is actually a great and complicated question, because there are ways in which, just as you have perspectives when you're in your 20s about, like, for example, what the next generation of technology is, what the wave of disruption is, what the next generation of market or consumer demand, especially amongst like consumer internet or consumer mobile properties. And so you do actually have to think, do you have the right perspective and skill set and drive and so forth for this particular entrepreneurial problem? And so you could have, because there are people who are young at heart. I know actually some of these like 50-year-olds who come and say, okay, you know, this is, I'm going to create a new, you know, thing for the young and a new game. And actually, in fact, that totally works. But 50-year-olds like will generally have the experience. It'll be better for enterprise software or other kinds of things. Whereas a 20-year-old might actually figure out what the next generation is going to see coming before anyone else. And you have to have that kind of range of lenses and experience. And then you have to be not biased by it. Now, you know, still, because it's the young kids on the block, still is that heroic story that a lot of Silicon Valley. So there's always that little bit of age distortion. But like, on the other hand, you know, if you keep young and if you keep nimble and you keep curious, like that kind of ongoing curiosity is one of our big themes and, you know, the podcast, the book and so forth, then actually, in fact, you know, you can overcome, you know, the remnants of ageism.
Interesting. And you talk about something called the mindset of the entrepreneur, whether you're 20 or you're 70. Can you sort of explain what the mindset of an entrepreneur is?
So the mindset of an entrepreneur is basically to see the fact that there could be something from nothing, a possibility of a new, you know, kind of future. In subtle ways, sometimes that future is an old pattern to a new thing. And then the willingness and the disposition to action. So one of the things that a phrase I use for this is jump off a cliff and assemble an airplane on the way down, which is, look, you're not going to pre-plan it too much. You just try to assemble some resources. You try to validate, like, hey, will I be able to assemble a plane? Probably, right? You wouldn't know for certain. It's, you know, worth some of that, but then you just go and you learn as you go and you iterate, you pivot, you change. And that predisposition to go create this future and willingness to take a certain amount of risk, jumping off a cliff, not having the plane assembled, you know, that set of things is, I think, key on the entrepreneurial journey.
I think one of the things that resonates with our audience so dearly about this is that we always take the approach on the show and in the book and our app that no one is born with the entrepreneurial mindset. No one is born with all the mindsets they need as an entrepreneur. You can actually cultivate them over time. And that's an enormously empowering perspective to take. And I know as a founder, it's been a huge asset for me to know, like, there are certain aspects of the entrepreneurial mindset I have. I'm naturally optimistic. I'm a possibilist. I'm comfortable in chaos. I know how to grow a culture. There's other mindsets that are a little more of a journey for me. I am not always the quickest decision maker. I sometimes have, instead of a bias to action, I'll sometimes have a bias to think about it a little. So there are areas where I can cultivate those mindsets that I wasn't naturally born with to supplement what I already had. And I think that's really freeing and empowering for our audience.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more when we return in just a minute.
Hey, this is Mark Bittman. You might know me from How to Cook Everything or The New York Times or The Bittman Project. I cover all things food, from cooking to gardening to fabulous ingredients to junk food, health, sustainability. You might say I'm obsessed with everything about food. And that's why I've started a podcast called, appropriately enough, Food. Each week on Food, I'll sit down with a different guest, ranging from Samantha Irby to Tom Colicchio to Ted Danson. We'll talk about cooking, eating, and how food affects us all. We'll talk recipes, ingredients, how to shop, what to cook tonight. Food is the one substance that connects everything to everything else, and it connects us all. Not only can we not live without it, not only does it determine much of what goes on in the world, but we love it. So subscribe now to Food with Mark Bittman on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Curious about the nuts and bolts of the stock market? It's not just for finance types anymore. Take it from a couple of regular guys, Dave and Andrew, who taught themselves about investing and teach it all on the Investing for Beginners podcast. Start with their Back to Basics series on episode 43 and use that knowledge to design your better financial future today.
There's no such thing as a born entrepreneur. Everything is kind of learned along the way, really. But are there people who just at least seem to have that innate entrepreneurial spirit?
Well, I think there's certain characteristics that are essential. So it's nature and nurture. It's never these kind of false dichotomies. And some of them, for example, is you have to have a certain amount of tolerance for chaos. You have to have a certain amount of tolerance for risk or for failing and playing again. And if you literally have zero tolerance of that, the entrepreneurial path is very, very difficult because it's pioneering, it's venturing into the unknown. And there are unknown unknowns when you go into it. And in actually, this is actually one of the things that June, who, you know, convinced me that I could be talent. I never would have thought that I was talent in any universe of the world, you know, kind of showed me about what was important about what we were doing in Masters of Scale was that there's a key thing that naturally is like problem solving, the lenses, the tools in order to solve this, but also the companionship and the energy and the narrative story of these journeys is actually, in fact, very helpful too, because you need to have that persistence into the unknown. Like one of the things I tell my entrepreneurs who I invest in is say, every startup has multiple valley of the shadow moments where you're like, why did we ever think this was a good idea? Like, oh my God, the world's clumbering around us. We're on the ship. It's sinking. We don't know how to fix the ship. And actually, in fact, everyone has that. And not everyone gets through it. You have to be willing to like, oh, this boat sinks and I get on the next boat, right? Or I build the next boat. But you can actually fix that. And that emotion and that connection to that journey is actually one of the things I think is really important as well.
In talking about all the hurdles along the way, and in many ways, you see them as positives because they make you actually think about why you're meeting these resistance, why a customer is responding this way. Some of the advice that you give in here, you know, in some ways may seem counterintuitive to some. For instance, you talk about seeking out resistance as a way of testing your idea, and also the fact that some resistance can be a sign that you're actually on the right path. June, you sort of experienced this when you were first suggesting putting TED Talks online, right?
I did. It's one of my favorite stories. So when I joined TED, I was employee 5. TED was just a conference. It was 1,000 people a year went to TED. And when I pitched the idea of bringing TED Talks online as a video series, this is 2005. YouTube had just launched. The video iPod wasn't even out yet. And when I pitched the idea of putting TED Talks online, it was universally seen as a very bad and very small idea. I mean, literally the almost nobody thought this was a good idea. And the 3 people who did were promptly pulled onto my team. And when I think back on that, I can think of all the people who said no. No one thought it was a good idea. But what's interesting to me about that is that before I worked on Master Scale, before I heard Reed's ideas on this, I always just interpreted that as my need for resilience. I needed to be resilient to work through the no's and know that it was a good idea. But what I've learned from Reed is that every single no helped me. I actually succeeded because of those no's, because when people told me, no, no one will listen because the videos are too long. Nobody will listen because the videos people are distracted. It drew a map around every trap I could have fallen into in putting TED Talks online. And so we specifically designed them to work despite all the reasons that people said no. So now I've rewritten my story. I believe TED Talks succeeded because of all the no's I heard. And that's the power of Reed's ideas around listening to every no and knowing how to categorize them and learn from them.
Yeah, Reed, you actually talk about the various types of no's in this book. What are the various no's and which are the most desirable for an entrepreneur? What kind of no do you want to hear in a meeting?
Well, the funny thing about no's, because obviously you think entrepreneurs want to hear yes, because like, yes, I'm going to go. Yes, this is a great idea. You're brilliant. This is wonderful. And that's the emotional reaction to Glenn. By the way, of course, like in investing and in hiring and in customers, you do need to get to some yeses. Otherwise, it doesn't work. However, just as June said, the challenge is typically it's kind of the no that it's like, okay, right, I just have to, you don't see it. I just have to be persistent. I have to like pound my head through a wall, you know, a brick wall in order to make this happen. And by the way, you do have to have grit and persistence. That's, you know, like it's one of the things. So you're listening for why are they saying no? And what you want is you want ideally people who are engaging with the idea who, and, you know, we kind of go through like the squirmy no and all the rest in the book. But you want people who are engaging with the idea who then will give you some thoughtful reason for why they think this is a no. Like in the early days of LinkedIn, well, the first person in LinkedIn, it's a network, it's only valuable because it's a network. First person in, no value, person by themselves in a network. They invite person two in. Person two already knows person one, no value for person two. That person invites in another person. Well, that's probably irrelevant to person one and already known to person two, no value. So you're like, no one's going to have any value. No one's ever going to invite anybody. Now, once you get that as kind of, and there's different kinds of the ways of listening to know, like sometimes it's like smart people, but you have a good idea. So you understand why you're contrarian and bright. Sometimes it's no, because they're uncomfortable about this. And that no, and it's kind of being uncomfortable about it means that actually, in fact, you might actually be into something huge here because it's kind of a shifted mindset. And you're looking for kind of the substance behind the no's in order to chart, just as June was saying, what the path to possible success is. It's like people say, well, we celebrate failure in Silicon Valley. No, we don't. We celebrate learning, and fast failing or understanding where the landmines are the ways to possibly get there.
Right. And you actually confide in here that not just you, but every VC has a secret list of the no's that should have been a yes, sort of the ones that got away. What's at the top of your list, Reed?
Well, it's unfortunately a long list, but I'd say probably the one that felt most personally foolish was Pinterest, because Ben Silberman and Paul Sciarra came in when it was kind of an angel round to my office at LinkedIn, and they pitched it. And I was like, I don't see this kind of collection mechanism as a new form of writing, a new media object. And I just didn't see it. And they were right, and I was wrong. And normally, I don't miss new media objects, right? It's an atypical miss, and it felt really like, no!
So funny. Hey, Reed, I'd love to build on that with almost like a bookend story, which is that speaks so clearly, like, oh, you missed it. It was like the same pattern, but somehow you missed it. One of the things that you've also brought out, and there's like a whole chapter in the book called Learn to Unlearn, that another challenge that people fall into is that we pattern too greatly after our successes. So we succeed at something and we're like, I'm brilliant. This idea was correct and it will always be correct. It's funny, I guess I'm referencing back to TED again, but you know, at TED, I had launched TED Talks with a team. I launched the TED Open Translation Project, which spread to 120 languages and something like 40,000 translations around the world. We launched TEDx, which is, so all of these successes with open models, Creative Commons talks, open translation, open event model. And then I went on to launch an open TV project. I was like, all of these TV broadcasters want to run TV. I'm going to launch this and it will be brilliant. Complete fail. It didn't work at all in that model. We launched an open API project. Didn't work at all. It's really interesting for me to look back now and realize like you have to also pattern really quickly of like learn, but then be really aware when it doesn't work anymore and then unlearn and learn a new pattern going forward. And that's not intuitive. That's another like really counterintuitive insight for entrepreneurs and anyone building anything.
Just to build on that, because one of the key things about scale is the lesson of what got you here won't necessarily get you there. And so the learn and unlearn sometimes isn't just the, is this a good idea or not? Am I on the right path to product market fit? But to scale product market fit and how you're doing it, either in how you're operating or what the product is or what the business model is, you actually, in fact, are doing that unlearning and relearning on the path to scale with the same idea.
And talking about learning and what you call, you know, doing things that don't directly lead to scale, but set the stage for scale. And also someone who initially received a lot of no's, including from some partners of yours at Greylock, Brian Chesky of Airbnb is a great example of this. Talk about kind of how he did his homework and really went through sort of a learning process before he was able to scale up. What did he do?
Yeah. So there's a reason we started the very first episode of Masters of Scale with Brian Chesky and Handcrafted, because it was the atypical pattern to Silicon Valley, which is, you know, generally looking for people who were started coding before they were 12. Design was never in the roadmap. You tend to think it's either engineers or product or salespeople, not design people, a whole stack of kind of contrarian things. It's one of the reasons why Brian actually had a long path to kind of raising money and making it successful. But part of what he did is bring the design mindset. And that design mindset is something that, you know, part of the reason we opened it was it's actually useful to all entrepreneurial and the way to think about. And it wasn't just like people normally think, oh, design of the website. It's like, no, design of the experience. And to think about like kind of opening with a, what does 11 out of 10 star design look like? What would be the, oh my God, this is amazing. And then kind of work back. And by the way, you'd handcraft and do some things. You said, well, this could get us to 9, but we can't quite do it on a scale version, but maybe we can do this version of it, which is an 8 and still really amazing. And so that kind of design process, which, you know, he borrows from Disney storyboarding and other kinds of design processes in order to get that right. And we're like, okay, this is important for everyone. And by the way, it was one of the things, reason we opened it, it was like, it was something I didn't have in my repertoire before I started working with Brian as kind of leading the Series A in Airbnb. But it was like, okay, this is the one to start with.
Interesting. It is a fascinating story. You talk about how he and his partners would say, we're going to send over a professional photographer to take pictures of your apartment. It would be the two of them, and how they had binders and binders of notes from Airbnb hosts and guests that they just collected as they started perfecting what they were going to do there.
Exactly. And that design, because what they did is they brought a design mindset and then were asking the folks, and sometimes well, they would reveal they were the founders and the host would go, why are you here? You know, so it's like, well, because we're learning and we're learning how to make this experience magical.
Now, I want to talk about culture. You know, for many companies and CEOs, it feels, at least for me from the outside looking in, like sort of an afterthought or something that CEOs sort of give lip service to. How important is the culture of a company to its success?
Part of the reason why we have so much in Master Scale and culture, we touch on it in multiple times, multiple interviews. And the reason is culture is one of the things that if you get wrong, it's very, very hard to fix. So the idea is get it right from the beginning. And there's a lot of different elements of it. Like, for example, people tend to misunderstand that you actually need to be very explicit, part of like writing documents, PowerPoints, et cetera. Part of what they think is it's be excellent. We're going to work hard. We're going to be smart. It's like, no. It's actually about who you are, what mission you are, how you work together, how you solve that problems. Key things like avoiding the fact that you're just going to hire a whole bunch of people who look like you and who kind of only have your particular cognitive biases, but actually, in fact, having some breadth of problem solving and breadth of knowledge and perspective as you're tackling the sequence of new problems, frequently as yet unsolved problems. And then the last kind of thing is that people tend to think culture is a little bit like the 10 commandments. It's like you wrote them on stone and we all obey these commandments now. And actually it evolves. And so when like you're interviewing people and you're bringing people in, you're thinking who should come? It's like, who helps make our culture better, stronger? How do we evolve it? Now, sure, there's principles and a foundation that you're growing out of, but you're growing in that direction. And then that's, you know, super important.
I think, Ben, what entrepreneurs and intrapreneurs will see in the book and here on the podcast are, A, the principles Reed mentioned, right? That culture is actually critical to achieving your mission, that it cements really early. Like you have to think about it from the beginning, but it also has to evolve. As Reed says, it's not on the 10 commandments. But I think what's so intriguing in the stories in the book is that these are all founders who are at the edge of their field and are inventing new ways into it that are unique to them. So it's not just a sort of a generic listicle of 10 things to think about with culture. It's really specific. Reed Hastings knew his specific challenge was that he was going to launch a DVD delivery service where his engineers would have to figure out how to wrap DVDs in red envelopes that don't break in the mail. And those same engineers would then have to build the pioneering streaming video service. It's a completely different skill set. And so he knew that he needed his employees to be first principle thinkers. They needed to think for themselves and they needed to be adaptable and nimble. And he built a culture for that from day one on like a total opposite end of the spectrum.
A legendary culture.
A legendary one. Another good example would be Melanie Perkins of Canva, a lesser known name in the US, but she's created a unicorn company with Canva. And Canva is a design tool that onboards users gracefully and easily. It's a super easy to use design tool. And to have that kind of empathy with your users where you are really anticipating their needs, she designed a culture that did that for their employees. So it is built into the DNA of their company that they're constantly thinking holistically about their customers and their users' experiences. And that also was from day one. So as a founder myself, listening to this and reading it, I don't think, oh, I need first principle thinkers or I need to onboard. I think, what is my mission and how do I attach it to my culture?
Well, let me ask you this, June. Do you think that more CEOs are putting culture front and center in the wake of Me Too and the backlash against broism in Silicon Valley and toxic work environments?
Yeah, I think both culture and diversity in all of its elements. And those are, they're related, but distinct in really interesting ways. And I think that increasingly, I think that 5 years ago, it was not widely known or accepted that either culture or diversity were critical, not just to a company's PR record, but actually their financial record, their ability to succeed. And I think that is much, much more commonly understood now, which is exciting, right? And the way Reed and I always think about it on the show, you know, these are things we care about deeply on a personal level and on an ethical level, but only if it makes sense on a business level. And so we feel like we at Masters of Scale have this like really wonderful opportunity to help accelerate history by helping people see the connection between great cultures and great businesses.
And Reed, there's something that I kept thinking about when I was reading this book, which is, can scale ever be a bad thing? You know, when I look at tech companies like Google and Facebook and Apple, who have reached such scale that they now have a big fat regulatory target on their backs, at a certain point, does a company need to pump the brakes lest it get swallowed up by its own mass?
So I don't think scale as a property by itself is a bad thing. I think there's questions about scaling badly versus scaling well. And I think there is a, if you're doing something like the what got you here won't get you there, you may need to change your game some and you may need to learn all of that. But there's a lot of part of the reason why the frequent entrepreneurial goal is to get to scale is that's the lever by which you have hopefully the most amazing positive impact on the world, right? You know, so for example, you go to Google, you say, well, let's try to make, you know, all the world's information available to everybody and make that level of knowledge and education and learning and finding the right kind of thing available everywhere. And that's, by the way, like you say, well, that would be great for 7 billion people on the planet. Like there's no scale limiter to that kind of mission. And most entrepreneurs have a mission that's somewhat like that. It's kind of the question of actually, in fact, there is a good that I'm really going for. Now, as you begin to get to scale, and this is one of the things I think, you know, and technology becomes the infrastructure, you're beginning to learn like, okay, well, not only are the individual my customer, but society is my customer. And how do I play within that? And what are the things that I need to do, given that I am now creating, you know, kind of like these internet and technology companies are larger than a lot of countries, right? In terms of the population and what does that kind of governance look like? And by the way, we're all learning this together. And I don't think the answer is, well, every single, you know, technology company should have a smaller number of customers than a country. It's actually beneficial to have like communication systems that everyone's on. It's beneficial to have information systems that everyone can use to find. And it's benefit to have the world connected in various ways. And that's all very good. It's just kind of a question of, well, now we're at this level of scale, what additional things should be put in to have it be healthy for the individuals and society? And then what's the sorts of decisioning that gets there, which is messy, because by the way, when you look at, you know, kind of governments and you go, well, should they be designing it? Well, frequently those folks, like if you look at that, clearly we should be doing infrastructure stuff to help the country. And yet in partisan fighting, you know, like the infrastructure stuff isn't happening and with the cleanliness it should be. And that's because the government making stuff happen is a complicated political process. So how you sort that out is challenging.
Yeah. And I should point out that you talk about scale, not just with CEOs, but with other people like politicians and, you know, nonprofits. And you talk about the importance of scale in addressing other big issues, not just business, but social issues, climate change. This book is not just for entrepreneurs in the traditional sense. You're applying it much more broadly here. So anyone can get some benefit from this. And interestingly, you suggest that part of why you did a book like this is that you hope that people will actually read it collectively. I'll ask both of you this. Why? I mean, aside from selling more books, what do you think companies and teams can derive from the collective experience of reading Masters of Scale?
There are a couple of things. And one of them is that we know that there are different modes. There are different things that really help people learn, right? First of all, some people are really audio learners and they're really drawn to podcasting. Many people aren't. Many people are actually really visual learners and are more drawn toward the book. We know that for most people, learning, and when I say learning, it's not just like learning, school learning, but like behavior change, habit change, mindset change happens in groups, that we learn from not just taking in information that we're pulling in, but from how we each interpret it. And when you get a group of people together who work together, who are sharing their insights, they will learn as much from each other as they do from the material they're taking in. So that's why we hope with everything. We actually know there are groups and companies that already do this with the podcast. We know there are groups who do that with the app. The book is actually an even more natural form for many people because book clubs have existed for so many years. So we hope that this becomes a communal experience, because that's where the learning happens, both between people and people who like turn it into action. Like, you don't think your way into a new way of acting, you act your way into a new way of thinking.
Just to add to that, the thing that books bring that also helps the group is that a podcast is very structurally a linear format. And so that's great for, you know, you're on your drive, you're on your run, you're, you know, kind of washing dishes or cooking and so forth, and you have that kind of thing. But a group environment is like, well, actually, this thing on page 6 or this thing on page 83, I thought was really interesting. And so being able to move back and forth between it in this kind of, you know, nonlinear format actually, in fact, is more amenable to, hey, we're talking about this together. That's why you have book clubs, and they kind of sit down and say, well, we all read this book and we're now talking about it as going. And obviously, given that these projects of scales always require large teams, so talking about it with your team, whether your team is, you know, a nonprofit, your team is government, your team is a corporation, your team is a startup, all of those things. And that's part of the facilitating the learning of entrepreneurship and the learning of the how you get to scale is kind of the key thing.
This is just great. There's so many wonderful insights in this book. Again, it's called Masters of Scale, Surprising Truths from the World's Most Successful Entrepreneurs. Reid Hoffman and June Cohen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. It was great to spend the hour with you.
Thanks again to Reid Hoffman and June Cohen for coming on the show. Order their new book, Masters of Scale, Surprising Truths from the World's Most Successful Entrepreneurs, at book.mastersofscale.com. Subscribe to Masters of Scale podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. And follow them on Twitter at Masters of Scale, at Reid Hoffman, and at June Cohen. If you enjoyed today's episode, then subscribe and give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Detailed reviews are the best way for new listeners to discover the show. Follow us on Facebook at @KickassNewsPod and email me with your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Kickass News is a part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com and check out some of our other shows like Food with Mark Bittman, Movie Therapy, Investing for Beginners, My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, and many others. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.
An Airwave Media Podcast.